Shabbat Mishpatim. And the Torah portion there was Shemot, Exodus 23:1-13. From the Haftarah we had Yirmiyahu, the prophet, Jeremiah 34:8-16. From the Messianic writings we had the letter to the Jewish community in Rome, and that was from chapter 2, verses 1-6. Imagine the scene, if you will, from last week leading into this week, this dry, hot, dusty day in the wilderness of Paran. The sun scorching overhead, your tongue sticking in the roof of your mouth with Mount Sinai before you. There we were, a nation waiting expectantly for God to speak, to come to meet with us. We hear the thunderings on the mount. In our fear and our panic, we say to Moshe, "You go." We push Moshe out to go ahead of us, to go up the mount, because the fear of God that came upon us at that point. "You go, Moshe, you receive the teachings of the Lord." And he did receive them amidst a powerful display of real spiritual, physical and celestial power of God on the mount. God spoke and the commandments were given. And that day where the pyrotechnics that we saw, heard, maybe even smelt and felt in our bodies left us in absolutely no doubt who was the boss. Who was really king? Because we had just come out of Egypt as a people, and for all that time that we were there, at least the last long section of it, we had known nothing but the oppression of Pharaoh. As far as Pharaoh was concerned, he had imprinted it upon our minds and upon our souls that Pharaoh was the king of the world. Pharaoh was the only one who had real power, real authority to do anything, to make anything happen. And everyone lived in fear of him. And now, free from Pharaoh, nevertheless, still imprinted upon our souls and upon our spirits was this feeling about Pharaoh and the power of Egypt. And now, having seen what we had seen, suddenly we began to realize there is another authority, there is another power in heaven. It is not Pharaoh after all. And all that expectation, all that excitement, all that fear that was upon us, that revelation that was given, the amazing awesomeness of everything which was said that day, received that day, all of the truth and understanding, the commandments that we begin to hear, all of this that would blow us away with its insight, depth, spiritual clarity, and frankly just the wow factor of all of this, given the time that it was given in. These are radical commandments of God, when no other nation around us was actually teaching or living out the level of righteousness that we see and read and hear in Torah. We certainly never saw it in Egypt. The other nations around Egypt were not teaching this either. This was something unique, given from heaven to us. It was a line in the sand from Adonai that said, "This is real righteousness and not what the nations are teaching you." And amongst all of this, which must have been completely mind-blowing for us, in that hot, dry, dusty atmosphere of the wilderness of Paran, we then expectantly are waiting for more dramatic words of God. And so we read in Shemot, Exodus 21:1, Ve'eli ha-mishpatim. These are the judgments. Great. Thanks for that. We needed that, didn't we? We were just getting excited. We thought something amazing was about to happen. We thought something awesome was here before us. And now we turn around and we hear, "Oh, and by the way, these are the judgments which I'm now going to tell you about." The judgments? We didn't want judgments. We were expecting good things. How encouraging to suddenly hear, "Here are the judgments." I say, tongue in cheek. And you know, it seems like a really harsh way to start something that in itself, frankly, is a beautiful revelation of God. If you understand Torah, if you understand the depth of that revelation that God gave us through the commandments, his teachings, the way to live and be, the awesomeness of all of this, and yet God calls them mishpatim, judgments. Would have been nicer if the Lord had said, and here are my teachings. That would have been great. I think we'd have handled that. We said, yes, please, we'll have your teachings. We can see your God. You know, we've covenanted ourselves. This is good. I like the teachings. But don't tell me your judgments. We've only just started. This is day one. I haven't put a foot wrong yet. How can I be judged? Not amazingly encouraging, we might think, of all of this. Almost like, you know, being set up to fail before you've even started the journey. That doesn't kind of make you get out of bed in the morning. If that isn't bad enough, it kind of gets worse. That first set of commandments that we read about in this portion before we kind of get into the building of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, next week. This whole set of early commandments is all about human-to-human interaction. Relationships. The treatment of servants and slaves. In particular, female servants. Wedding rights, issues pertaining to violence towards one's fellow man, and restitution, compensation for damage, ensuring the safety of others when animals might attack or harm them, as well as how we treat animals. Those with whom we are not to have relationships, sorcerers, those committing bestiality, they should be stoned. How we deal with strangers, gerim, converts, and others who are neighbours on this shared planet that we live on. The list goes on. This is this first inkling of something that God is giving us here, which we need to understand, because the Lord describes these as judgments. These are not just commandments. There's something powerful about these commandments which we need to get our head on. The first bit of this revelation effectively says, I will judge you on how you treat each other. That's a sobering thought. That should bring us up short, I think. How you treat each other is how I will begin to judge you. In the core of this idea, of the commandments being a judgment against us, I believe, sits a revelation that we need to get our heads around and understand. If we can see the connection for a moment, we realise that in each of these commandments that we have here, we have been given these to bring us conviction as sinners in each specific area. How we treat each other, how we treat other people, how we treat slaves and converts, how we treat animals. It's all about that interaction with other people and other animals and other things. And we are meant at that point to be convicted, because that's the area we begin to fail God first in. As bizarre as it may seem, if you think of the two highest commandments which we have got, so you can see the rationale in this. The first commandment is what? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, strength, soul and might. Amen? And the second is like it. It is to love your neighbour as yourself. You see, the second commandment, or if you like, the second highest commandment up there with all of them, immediately focuses on other people. Why? Because dealing with other people is the first area you are going to see your rebellion against God. When you start turning your back against God, I guarantee the people that will suffer will be those around you. That's where you're going to tell first. That's what you're going to see. Why? Well, it's kind of strange. It's kind of interesting when you see it this way. Just like we said with the nations raging against Israel, because actually they're raging against God. Why is it that the first thing that we attack when we begin to move away from God is other people? Because other people contain what? The image of God. Becomes too easy. The first thing we were going to attack. The first thing that we will lash out at. And you see, you begin to understand now why these early commandments are called Mishpatim, judgments against us. Because they convict us as sinners in each and every one of these areas of interpersonal relationships. How we treat each other. What we eat, don't eat, what we worship, how we dress, etc., etc. Each and every one of them, actually, when we bring ourselves up against those commandments of God, we discover to our astonishment that we fall short. Sometimes when I'm going through Jewish blogs and or on the internet, I come across some quite amazing statements. So you could take them at face value. I tend not to, because I just believe what the scriptures say, what the Torah say, that sometimes I'll say Rabbi so-and-so and so-and-so, who is a perfect man. I have yet to meet a perfect human being. I've not met one yet. Because I guarantee you, if you searched in any single human being's life, you would find some sin. I guarantee it to you. Even King Shlomo said it himself, there is not one who has not fallen short of God's glory. That came from Shlomo's mouth, not from mine. But Rav Shaul reiterated it again and again, but it's the truth. Every single human being has committed some sin at some point in their lives. Even our greats have committed sin. Even Moshe didn't get into the land. Why? Because he sinned. King David was perfect, yes? Far from it. The prophets, they were perfect, yes? No, they weren't. Do you want me to continue? You get the picture. In fact, even when we get to someone like Rav Shaul, who was trained under Gamaliel in the first century, someone who knew his Torah inside out, off by heart, lived it, was trained in it day after day after day. You know how he describes himself in one of his letters that he wrote? He said, I am the sinner of all sinners. Well, you know what? If Rav Shaul is a sinner, Lord have mercy on me. Because I do not know and have not walked in righteousness as that man did. And I know that for a fact. And when we come up against the commandments of God, the statements of his righteousness, of his justice, each and every one defining how we live highlights our own shortfall and our failings to match up to his standards, which begs a question. Here comes the radical bit. Are you ready? Are you sitting down? Good, I can see you are. Who was the Torah given to? It's a serious question. Answer? The Jewish people, yes? It's not a trick question. I'm not trying to catch you out. I'm not losing it, not yet. It's given to the Jewish people, right? The Torah was given to us. Let me rephrase the question. Who is the Torah for? Now you see, this gets interesting, doesn't it? Who is it actually for? The Torah was given to us as the Jewish people. That is true. But you see, to go beyond that statement, to then say that Torah is only for the Jewish people, that's when it begins to get a bit shaky. What do I mean by this? I'm trying to be radical, bear with me. If Torah is only for the Jewish people, that means that the Jewish people have a monopoly on sin. Get it? Because we only know what sin is. What is sin? What is the definition of sin? Breaking a commandment. The mitzvot. You break the mitzvot, that is a sin, yes? Are we all in agreement? If it's only given to the Jewish people and only for the Jewish people, then only the Jewish people can sin. In which case, the goyim out there are running around us laughing, saying, hey, we're okay. Are they okay? They are far from okay. Is it right if a goy goes and murders another goy? Is that right? What condemns them when they do that? The commandments of God. In fact, let's be specific. It's the commandments of the God of Israel condemns them at that point. Because you know what? There is no other law code on this planet in that sense than a revelation that has come down to forbid murder. It comes from Hashem. Now it kind of gets interesting, doesn't it? Torah, I'm going to be radical here and say this morning. The Torah is for sinners. Putting it into Rav Shaul's words, I'm going to just do this very quickly. I'm just going to dip into something he wrote here, because this, he says it way better than I can say it. So I'm just going to put it directly into his words here. This comes again from that letter to the community in Rome. This is from chapter 3. He says, where's the boasting in all of this? Excluded. There is no boasting, he says. Of what Torah will I boast? Of what mitzvot will I boast? No, he says, I will boast by the Torah of faith, of trusting, of God's own righteousness. And he concludes, is our God the God of the Jewish people only? Is he not also the God of all the goyim too? Is he not the God of all? Of course, we know this. He says, yes, also, the Goyim too. Since there is how many gods? One God. You see, if God is one God, if he is the only God, and it's only for the Jewish people to know this God, we are condemning the Gentiles to eternal damnation and hell, because they can never come to the God of Israel, and never come to his righteous standards, because it's for us alone. Rav Shaul is having none of this. He's beginning to work it all out. He's putting it together. He says, there is only one God. What do we expect the Gentiles to do? To worship the one true God is to come to the God of Israel. He says we will justify through faith. And then this concludes, which is amazing. Do we make void Torah through faith? Absolutely not, he says. On the contrary, we establish Torah. It's a radical statement by a highly esteemed first century rabbi. A radical statement. This is the revelation, if you like to see it this way, that Rav Shaul gets at this point, was that sin was an issue not just for Jewish people, it was an issue for everyone. Everyone has fallen short of the glory of God. There's only one difference in all of this. We as the Jewish people, we should know better. Because to us was given Torah. We know the righteous standards of God. The Goyim do not. But we do. And our job and our call, our task has always been to take that level of righteousness out to the nations, to preach the God of Israel and his salvation, and show the nations of this world and the Goyim the true righteousness of God. And that if they want it too, they can come and convert and join us. That has been our message, and should continue to be our message. We have no monopoly on sin. Sin only has one definition, and it's a Jewish definition. Anything else is not going to work. So we begin to understand through all of this that when God calls this a judgment, it's not just a judgment upon us, it's a judgment upon anyone who would come up against the God of Israel and measure their behaviours, their attitudes, their lifestyles, measure themselves before God's own holiness and righteousness, and then to understand that they have fallen short. And I think the beauty of what Rav Shaul is saying through all of this is that we move away from this kind of Jewish particularism that we've often seen and move it to a Jewish universalism, which of course is the flip side of the coin of Judaism. We've always known, the prophets have always known, that Judaism has a glorious future, not just for Israel and the Jewish people, but to shine it out amongst the nations, that the nations will respond. Read the prophets, it's written loud and clear. I'm not making this up. The call has always been to a Jewish universalism to reach out to those around us and say, come and join us, because to us has been given the oracles of God. To us has been given the revelation of Adonai and his righteous standards, and we too can teach them to you. Am I mad to conclude this? I don't think so. If I put it this way, it sounds mad. Judaism isn't for good people. Judaism is for those who know they fail God and nevertheless want to find him. For people who know they need him and to receive his mercy, love, forgiveness and the atonement which he alone can provide. That's what Judaism's for. That's why when we read, these are the judgments. These are the judgments against you, because at that moment when we line ourselves up, we realise, what have we got, Lord? We are brought to the foot of his mercy, and always have been in Judaism, always should be in Judaism, that we shouldn't be able to stand on our own merits and our own this, that and the other, what we have done. We should be flat on our faces before God. That is the only response to a holy, righteous God. Not to start arguing, but I kept this commandment, I kept that commandment. I'm sure when God looks into each and one of, every one of our hearts, he will see the failings of where we've not managed to do the commandments that he's given us to do. Our call, task is to take this salvation message, if you like, this message of redemption, that God is able to take you, a sinner, judged by the righteous commandments of God, can take you and bring you into that place of redemption through his atonement. That's the message which Judaism needs to preach and needs to teach. We start to see it reflected next week when we get into the building of the Mishkan, the sacrifices that are beginning to bring. You know, God didn't just look at the animals and think, you know what, wouldn't it be a jolly idea if we started sacrificing thousands of bulls? To take a living life, be it animal or human, is serious. You don't do it jestingly. And when the Lord said we should begin to sacrifice, it wasn't because he enjoyed the smell of blood in that way. It was a serious act because it said so much about the seriousness of sin and the seriousness of, from God's perspective, of ensuring that we were able to come before his face. God has always provided that atonement all the way through, right to the very end for Yeshua. Each and every step of the way, it has always been God's way of atonement. He has always told us what to do. We've never worked it out ourselves, that's for sure. And here comes the clue, I think, in all of this. We as the Jewish people, God's people, have been dropped behind enemy lines. Here a light begins to go on what our call and task in all of this is. You know, we find it so extraordinarily difficult to live in this world at times, the persecution, the attacks, this constant uphill battle that we feel, overcoming daily in his power, but feeling around us this environment to be hostile to our presence as a nation, as a people, in our communities and synagogues. This is our daily living. The reason why it's like this is because we effectively have been parachuted into alien territory, difficult enemy territory, because we've got a job to do. And our job is to reach out to those outside who are suffering in pain of being just human with the situations and events they find themselves in. The brokenness of humanity that we see before us. I'm not even talking about the obvious things, the drug addicts and the alcoholics and so on. That's bad enough. But it's just the sufferings that people go through in their daily lives. All of this that sin has created and destroyed in this world. And God says to us, you, my people, I want you to show this world. Sin can be beaten. There is another way. You can have my righteousness. You can live in this holiness that I can give you. And I will give you my power to make sure this is possible. In fact, as the prophet said, I will cause you to walk in my righteousness. That's our calling and our task. And it's this idea of brokenness which I think is so powerful in all of this. We're talking about it this year in our leaders' conference coming up in a few weeks, dealing with brokenness and living in a broken world in this way. But you know, our communities, our synagogues, our messianic synagogues like this, are literally spiritual recovery centres, hospitals of faith. That is what we are. Because we have got something powerful that we can offer those who are in pain. We are equipped through the power of the salvation that we have through Yeshua to set captives free who have been dominated, controlled by the forces of evil in this world, and repatriate people back to God. Why? Because every single human being bears the image of God. It is simply not good enough for us to say, we'll go and help other Jews. Do it, please. I'm not saying don't, but it's not the end. Every human being bears the image of God. And there's one thing I have to say, I take my hat off to Netanyahu and people in his government and the way Israel so admirably and nobly responds in the face of aggression and hatred, that we do not flatten Gaza. Because you know what, it must go through the head. But the response is so appropriate, they're so careful, announcing before action is taken and warning people to get out the way and so on and so on and so on. None of which, of course, is accorded to us when we are attacked. It's because Israel takes that higher path. It's because we know a higher path. But you know what that makes us as the people of God? As the troops, if you like, we are. We carry our scars of our own deliverance and battles with joy. You see, people often will say to me, Rabbi, I've got this, I've had that, that caused me harm, that caused me pain. And you know what? We're maybe looking at these things the wrong way around. If God has set you free of things, if he has delivered you and taken you out of the situations and taken that pain from you, it's because he has glorified himself in you. But it doesn't stop there. You don't therefore pat yourself on the back. You take that scar to someone else and you say what? If God can do this for me, he can do it for you. What I'm saying is here is wear your scars with pride. Someone once asked me a question. They said, why is it when Yeshua was resurrected from the dead, why is it that he still had the scars in his body? Why is it that the man put his hand in Yeshua's side? Why was he not healed in his complete, perfect body? Why? Because Yeshua bore his scars with pride. Because each scar said, this is what I paid. This is the cost of what it means to be behind enemy lines. This is the cost of what it means to bring redemption and atonement. The cost of deliverance is the pain that you bear in your body. But if you use that pain to bring redemption in other people, it is a powerful way of atonement and a powerful message that we can take to other people. That our God is able to save to the uttermost. If we have been redeemed, if we have been set free, then maybe others can too. All of which takes us to the one who bore those scars in his body. He suffered, and because he suffered, we can have that salvation. But you know, in conclusion, it'll be very easy to just leave you with the thought that the Torah is there somehow to just bring that condemnation, to bring that judgment upon us. I just want to leave you with this thought, because Yeshua had an answer to that question. And his answer to the question we posed at the very beginning is this. This is coming from the Besorah that we have written from the testimony of Yochanan and chapter 3. And he says this. For Adonai did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, to bring judgment upon the world. No. Why did he send him? That the world through him might be saved. You see, I think this is an amazing concept when you see it this way. That yes, Torah, each commandment in a sense will bring that condemnation upon you. It is meant to show you that you have failed God. But don't ever think that that's the place that God has left you. Because he's sent away to show you that you don't have to be living a condemned life all your lives. Because there is one who was sent, whose role it was not to bring condemnation, whose role it was not to walk around from synagogue to synagogue in the first century saying, you're a bunch of sinners, you're a bunch of losers, you're going to hell. Is that clear? Good, I'm moving on to the next place. That is not what he said. Yeshua's only thought in all of this was not to condemn, but to bring life in all its fullness. That's what his life was. Because in him he revealed the life of Adonai, the real life, the real spiritual life that is able to bring real life into our lives and stop us from living in that world of death. Showing that in each and every situation, that no situation is too bad that cannot be redeemed for those who wish it to be so. Yeshua said, I did not come for those who need a physician. Isn't that interesting? He said, look, I didn't come for those who think they're righteous. He came for sinners. He came for sinners. Torah was given for sinners. Because it was the road that brought us to redemption, to God's mercy and his atonement. It was for sinners the Torah was given. It was given to the Jewish people as a nation to live out as the antidote, to be the living examples of God's atonement and possibility that, that sin could be overcome, that sin could be forgiven. That's our national calling and our task. It was at Sinai the case, and today, X thousand years on, it is still the case. Nothing has changed. If we feel condemned, then we need to make our case clear before God and stand before him and say, yes, this is me. I have fallen short of your glory. Have mercy upon me. and give me your salvation. Amen.